So, this last lecture is on talking. And ironically, it's on not talking too much, which I can't reasonably, I guess, do by example because, you know. But, you know, a lot of the material in the Bible dealing with speech and anger, or material dealing with speech and anger occurs together. And that's for much the same reason that we intuitively in the Western world and in the United States think about drinking and driving. All right. You know, we're given all sorts of warnings about them because the danger of driving irresponsibly is way easier to do or way easier experience or way easier to subject yourself to if you're drinking irresponsibly and get behind a wheel. All right. And so they're put together often, and again, James is a letter that has a lot of wisdom in it, and it summarizes it this way. Know this, my beloved brothers, let every person be quick to hear, slow to speak, and slow to anger. Notice that the progression here follows a lot of the wisdom of Proverbs. James says to listen rather than to speak or vent your anger. And then he moves to the point of listening, which is to take action rather than argue about it. Because he goes on to say, if you listen to the word, don't forget what you read. Don't be like a person who looks in the mirror and doesn't remember what he looks like. So all these proverbs, the way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but a wise man listens to advice. Now, that's interesting. The definitive mark of a wise man is not that he says stuff, it's that he listens. Now, there's stuff about what the wise man says too, but still, the way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but a wise man listens to advice. That's Proverbs 12:15. Earlier, the wise of heart will receive commandments, but a babbling fool will come to ruin. So, the wise of heart listens, but a fool, he's wise in his own eyes, so he keeps talking. And he doesn't hear anyone else. Too busy listening to himself. This is 10:8. 18:2. A fool takes no pleasure in understanding, but only in expressing his opinion. And Proverbs 14:23. In all toil there is profit, but mere talk tends only to poverty. This stuff is over and over. And, James' letter, as in James' letter, warnings about uncontrolled speech and uncontrolled anger often go together in Proverbs. For example, consider the following passage. And here I'm going to actually talk about a section of Proverbs, Proverbs 17:27 through 18:1-4. 18:4. So, listen to this. Whoever restrains his words has knowledge, and he who has a cool spirit is a man of understanding. Even a fool who keeps silent is considered wise. When he closes his lips, he is deemed intelligent. Whoever isolates himself seeks his own desire, he breaks out against all sound judgment. A fool takes no pleasure in understanding, but only in expressing his opinion. I read that earlier. When wickedness comes, contempt comes also, and with dishonor comes disgrace. The words of a man's mouth are deep waters. The fountain of wisdom is a bubbling brook. Now, just in general, before I go into some specifics, I want to think about the culture we have today in America and about a culture that we get transmitted to us and have for many years in the form of watching television sitcoms, which many people do all their lives. If I think about the many hours I occupied watching sitcoms from a small child on up, and that was before the Disney Channel, it explains a lot about what kind of speech I've encountered and practiced, perhaps, and why it has often not worked out that well for me. Because the essential feature of virtually all sitcoms, for every age, and whatever else is going on, whatever other immoralities or evils that are in them, the essential feature is that someone outwits someone else in a quick repartee or quick response, verbal response. That happens over and over and over again. Sometimes not that well, but they put the laugh track on it and this is what they do. someone outwits someone else, verbally. As a person encounters a situation, he says something on the spot that is really clever. That is like the sine qua non of you know, being a smart guy in our culture. When he has an argument, he makes an off-the-cuff response that seems funny and smart, if insulting, and this goes on and on. And what is true in every case is that no one is actually thinking up anything to say on the spot. No one. No one spontaneously comes up with a witty comeback. It is all scripted. It is all written beforehand by a team of writers and memorized by actors. So a system of writing, plotting, memorization, and rehearsal is used in our culture to promote an ideal of how people should talk to one another in a quick, spontaneous, and witty manner. All right, in the passage above that I've read, in other passages, Solomon's telling us that this does not work in real life. It's never worked in real life. It doesn't work out. And not just because it's mean or gross, but because it's stupid. Intelligent human beings who want to prosper in the world cannot afford to operate their mouths that way. In the Bible generally, having the right words for the right situation is considered very difficult. It's hard. When Jesus told his disciples that they would have to speak for him, he immediately promises them supernatural help. Luke 12:11-12. When they bring you before the synagogues and the rulers and the authorities, do not be anxious about how you should defend yourself or what you should say, for the Holy Spirit will teach you in that very hour what you ought to say. Now, he didn't say that because it wasn't necessary. He said that because it was. I mean, it's true. I guess sometimes we do have improvs where, you know what, most of those don't sound that good. And if they do, it's because they're selectively edited for us on television. I mean, it's all a ruse. We cannot talk that way. You cannot be smarter than the smarter you are, the faster you'll think. So you cannot afford to let that stuff out of your mouth without thinking some more about it. So let's, with that in mind, let's look at Proverbs 17:27-18:4. So I'll read it again, the first two verses. Whoever restrains his words has knowledge, and he who has a cool spirit is a man of understanding. Even a fool who keeps silent is considered wise. When he closes his lips, he is deemed intelligent. By the way, that I recently thought more about that second verse, about even a fool. Is Solomon really giving him advice saying that, you know, if you're a fool, at least you can pretend? Or is he hoping to tell a fool how to at least make a start and start to stop being a fool? C.S. Lewis is something like that, where he says, you know, you should imagine what a righteous person would do, or a person who is a better Christian than you are, and then pretend you're that person for a while and see if it doesn't take. You know, fake it till you make it. And I wonder if you don't have that here. I don't see how else you can describe that. But in any case, this first verse is about restraining one's speech and not making angry expressions. Verse 28 is also about speech. And again, it's about not doing too much about it. These are not separate aphorisms. They're basically on a theme here. You see? You can't trust your mouth. You have to be careful. And next we read, whoever isolates himself seeks his own desire, but he breaks out against all sound judgment. And then a fool takes no pleasure in understanding, but only in expressing his opinion. Now, I used to think Proverbs 18:1 by itself, because I isolated it, no pun intended, from this context. I used to think that was about going off and living by yourself or something. That doesn't fit in the context of these other passages. They're all about the same thing. You isolate yourself when you talk too much for anyone else to get a word in to you, to tell you that you're wrong, or to give you any kind of other possibility. You're hostile to sound judgment, right? It says, the person who isolates himself, he breaks out against all sound judgment. Sound judgment, that's stuff you hear from other people. You can't listen. You're too busy talking. So the warning to isolate yourself is a warning, again, about restraining yourself from speaking so you have time to hear. Be slow to speak, quick to hear. Quick to hear, slow to speak. And then you have a general warning against wickedness. All right, when wickedness comes, contempt comes also, and with dishonor comes disgrace. And then you go right back into speech. The words of a man's mouth are deep waters. The fountain of wisdom is a bubbling brook. Now I want to camp there on that last passage, that last verse about the deep waters and the fountain. But looking back at 1727, consider how Solomon's pictures speech, the image, the model he's giving us. He's giving us a way of thinking. To say whoever restrains his words has knowledge and visions, that he's got a lot of them, and they're locked up inside on the other side of his lips, and most of them should stay there. It presupposes that the key to intelligent speech, to winsome speech, is more about figuring out what not to say than about figuring out what to say. The problem isn't creating the right words as much as being selective so you don't let out the wrong ones. And so other Proverbs say the same thing. Proverbs 10:19. When words are many, transgression is not lacking, but whoever restrains his lips is prudent. I mean, it reminds you of what James says later in chapter 3, you know, keep your tongue on a leash. That's my really poetic paraphrase. The picture seems to be that you have a huge supply of words. Look, you're smart people. You know, you have a busy brain. They buzz with information. But not all of it, you know, when you brainstorm, the key is to eliminate a bunch of stuff, right? You don't do that in front of other people that you're trying to talk to. Do that in private. You speak slowly. You will do the most good and demonstrate the most intelligence and love if you release only some of those words. The rest can stay locked up. Now, why would it be that way for Christians, right? I mean, we're good people. We have good intentions. You know, we know a bad person needs to be restrained from speaking bad words, but why should a righteous man not expect his words will be righteous? Well, think about learning to drive. I've talked about this before. You don't have necessarily, as I said, a smooth and easy beginning when you first experience driving. It's jerky. All that power, you have to learn how to restrain your ankles and your muscles to only let on a little or only brake gently. And this isn't hard for you to do. Eventually, with practice, you get pretty good at it. You don't even think about it anymore. You know, a new driver is just not used to having all that power under the control of a twitch of his foot. The car can go immensely fast, faster than it usually ever needs to go, especially when you're trying to get out of your driveway. And, you know, you can brake really hard, harder than you should have to if you're looking ahead of yourself and you're aware of traffic. So having all that power under your control, you have to get used to that. You have to learn to restrain the power of the car, i.e. not use too much of it. And as I said, James uses the similar analogy for speaking. You know, I used part of this before about the tongue. We all stumble in many ways, but anyone who does not stumble what he says is a perfect man or a mature man. He talks about horses, but then he talks about something else. Look at the ships also. Although they are so large and are driven by strong winds, they are guided by a very small rudder, wherever the will of the pilot directs, with his practiced hands, we might say. Our words are powerful. There are huge winds. The word brainstorm is actually a very, very appropriate one in this context. God made us to do amazing things by our speech, through our words. And for that reason, it is important to think about what we want to happen as a result of our speech, and to speak according to what we want and not what makes us feel vindicated or powerful. And that not only requires love towards man and obedience to God, but it also requires for us to think before we speak, to use a cliche. And the only way we can possibly do that, the only way we have time to think about what the best thing to say is if we get in the habit of hesitating to speak. Speaking slowly is generally, now not always, but generally, a good habit. I mean, it is a good habit. It's not sometimes something else to call for. and we have to do it. But I'm saying the general habit should be slow to, it's like being angry. There are times that call for anger. But for us always to think about those times and justify every instance of anger with those times, that would be like, you know, using the Reformation to always justify being obnoxious in church or something. That's crazy. Who would do that? So we need to be careful what kind of scenarios we play out in our brains, because they can be self-justifying fantasies rather than real issues. Consider a well-known proverb. A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Now, that's not a hard principle to figure out. Anyone who has been around people for any length of time should know that. It's almost surprising that God would have to tell us in this inspired scripture, because you think we'd all know that. Nothing is more obvious. And yet, I mean, it tells us, by the way, that not only the content, not only the words are important, but also the tone. And she tells us about that. And we think, well, why would a person not take that in consideration? Does he not care? He doesn't care about wisdom. He doesn't care about his harsh words stirring up anger. He's fine with that. Who cares how many enemies you make? Who cares how many people get mad at you? No, that's folly. But even a person who's committed to loving others and being kind can become upset. You see, I mean, you issue a harsh reply when someone makes you angry, right? And when you are like that, your principles or things you memorized or commands you know about, they kind of go out the window. You forget them. You forget them. You blurt out the first thing that comes to mind before you think about the harm it will do. So this is why you have things like habits. You know, anger is self-motivating. You do not need to be motivated when you're angry. That's a self-motivational state of being. You act. You want to act. What you have to learn is to cut that off and also be proactive and act when you don't want to. You know, motivate yourself by other means. That's the kind of equipment that we have as people made in God's image. That's our both at our neurological, biological, and our personalities. That's what we're like. So we're warned against. That's why James sums it all up as every person be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger. We're warned against angry speech, not only because anger is sinful sometimes, not always, it's sometimes sinful, but because speaking while angry is easily sinful and even self-destructive. And it comes up over and over again in Proverbs. Good sense makes one slow to anger. And it is glory. This is how he tries to reprogram you. It is his glory to overlook an offense. All right, you should take pride in your ability to not let other people anger you. You should say, that's the mark of a real man. That's what makes me a champion. That's what makes me a king. Again, anger, is angry always wrong? No, but your habit needs to be slow to anger, and your values, you need to think that through. Any idiot can get angry. And that's actually, believe it or not, I don't read much Aristotle, but that's actually something he says I think is correct. You know, anybody can get angry, but to get angry at the right time, in the right way, for the right purpose, you know, that takes skill. You want to have skill. You want to be a really, truly productive and powerful human being, as a man or a woman. You want to be that. The feeling of power that comes with anger, that often is illusionary. That is a kind of high you get. It goes back to when you had temper tantrums as a child. It doesn't work. It doesn't help you. Whoever is slow to anger has great understanding. He who has a hasty temper exalts folly. That's why it's so backwards to think of the witty comeback as like the mark of intelligence, because the smarter you are, the more bizarre words you've got, associations you make. You gotta be careful how much you let that out. So you need to learn to restrain your words, and thus, when you let some words out, you can be a fountain of wisdom, which is what this passage ends with. So, you know, I realize that sometimes people need to express themselves to close friends. Sometimes they're hurt, sometimes they're angry. Sometimes, you know, a counselor can help you, especially a counselor who you will listen to for their take and not be angry at them when they don't agree with you as much as you expected them to, or see the incredible wisdom and how right you were. You know, you got to be able to listen as well as vent, okay? But you need to be very careful if you do that, who is who, because you're not strengthened by that. There really literally isn't pressure on you that if you don't release it, you're going to be unhealthy or something. That's not true. You can deal with it in other ways, for one thing. You can pray. You know, you read the Psalms. Let God take all that anger. He does. But you need to be careful. You need to not think of getting it off your chest. If you don't have a purpose for what you say and an outcome that you are hoping to get to that is at least not impossible, then maybe you shouldn't say it. I mean, what good is it going to do otherwise? Now, I realize there's room for cowardice in there. You got to be careful. You do meet your obligations and challenges, but you got to think this way, at least as your first thought. Let's remember the goal. The Apostle Paul, speaking on another subject, spells out the goal of maturity and defines it as self-rule. We aren't under the power of waves and wind, Ephesians 4:14. I read that earlier. Each one of us is made in God's image, and we're supposed to take dominion over our lives. We are not going to be able to do that well if we feel obligated to speak on the basis of our immediate feelings or thoughts at the moment and not on the basis of what we want to achieve. Solomon says that our ability to choose our spoken words and leave others unexpressed makes us greater. Restraining our words does not restrain us, but empowers us. Now, actually, I left out my Ephesians passage, and I'm going to read it now by actually turning in the Bible here, which is handily right by my podium. All right, here. Because he spells out productive speech. I want to read that actually for a couple of reasons. No. Oh, there's Ephesians in my Bible. That's good. No, I actually have read this book before. Okay. Therefore, having put away, this is, okay, 4:25. Therefore, having put away falsehood, let each one of you speak the truth to his neighbor, for we are members of one another. Be angry, by the way, that comes out as, basically that means don't lie to each other or deceive another. It doesn't necessarily mean speak everything you know, think you know is true, but I'll go on there. Be angry and do not sin. See, speech, anger, go together. Do not let the sun go down on your anger, and give no opportunity for the devil. In other words, get over your anger. Let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor, doing honest work of his own hands, so that he has something to share with anyone in need. This, by the way, is where Paul is imitating Solomon. He's putting together completely what seem like completely different subjects, but they actually are. The thief is an analogy for how you talk. You want to not rob each other's dignity. You want to contribute to each other, because that's exactly what he says next. Thieves no longer steals, but works to make productive labor to give to others in need. Then, let no corrupting talk come out of your mouth, but only such as is good for building up as fits the occasion, that it may give grace to those who hear. Now, I'll stop there. He goes on to talk about let no bitterness, anger, and all that. He's emphasizing his point, but my point is, so you can see how hard that is. That takes thought. You are supposed to say the right word again for the right time to build up and give grace to those who hear. That's difficult. If you just speak without thinking, it will probably be a lot of corrupting talk. So think about that. We restrain our words. It empowers us to do that. We take some thought. Jesus died and rose again as a new creation to reestablish us as men and women, charged to take dominion over creation. As James tells us, one of the most difficult challenges is taking charge of our own speech. But it is also one of the most important for our own happiness, for our witness, and for subduing the world, for creating these communities that God wants to see in the world. And in Proverbs 18:4, Solomon uses a metaphor that goes back to the story of creation. The words of a man's mouth are deep waters. The fountain of wisdom is a bubbling brook. So the context would indicate that the fountain of wisdom refers to wise words that nourish and refresh, but the words of a man's mouth are all possible words that one might say and a foolish person would allow to pour out of himself. But a wise man doesn't say all that. More selective. He keeps up. Compare Proverbs 20:5. The only other reference to deep water, the purpose of in a man's heart is like deep water, but a man of understanding will draw it out. Here it's being used in a different context or a different idea, but I think it's the same thing. That there's all this deep, you've got this sea of stuff behind you. What do you let out? The question is, what will you let out? Be careful. You know, in Genesis 1, we were told that God created the heaven and the earth in the beginning, but the earth was undeveloped, right? It was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. The Spirit of God hovering over the waters and starts changing things. And from that point, God illuminated and ordered the earth by speaking, by talking. Now, when wisdom describes her role in creation, she singles out waters for special treatment. So let me read this to you. This is 8:23-31. I've mentioned it before, but I'm going to read it now. Ages ago, I was set up at the first, before the beginning of the earth. When there were no depths, I was brought forth. When there were no springs abounding with water, before the mountains had been shaped, before the hills, I was brought forth. Before he had made the earth with his fields, or the first of the dust of the world. When he established the heavens, I was there. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep. All right, those deep waters. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep. When he made firm the skies above. When he established the fountains of the deep. When he assigned to the sea its limit, so that the waters might not transgress his command. When he marked the foundations of the earth, then I was beside him like a master workman, and I was daily at his delight, rejoicing before him always, rejoicing in his inhabited world, and delighting in the children of man. There is only one element there, one aspect of creation that receives the command. It's told not to transgress. Everything has their place, but one is singled out for that kind of attention. The waters are to stay within a boundary. They are assigned a limit. They must not transgress. And, you know, if we delve into the imagery of the Bible, and you probably already, a lot of you already know this, so bear with me, but there's always this concept of the sea or the ocean representing chaos. Sometimes evil, but at least chaos, the uncontrolled potentiality that you have to be careful about that can spread. You know, Genesis 1, the deep of Genesis 1 and the seas, they're kind of intermingled with each other. And the sea is an image of that chaos. So we get Psalm 89:8-10. O Lord God of hosts, who is mighty as you are, O Lord, or who is mighty as you are, O Lord, with your faithfulness all around you, you rule the raging of the sea. When its waves rise, you still them. You crush Rahab, who's a name for a sea monster, like a carcass. You scatter your enemies with your mighty arm. I think Rahab here is a reference actually to Egypt as a dragon. Isaiah 31:7 gives you the basis for this, with Genesis 1:21 as a kind of background image, the background in the creation story. God's defeat of Egypt at the Red Sea is like creation, and it's subduing these raging waters, controlling the chaos of the ocean, assigning it a limit. And we have that also in Isaiah 51:9-10. Awake, awake, put on strength, O arm of the Lord, awake as in days of old, the generations long ago. Was it not you who cut the Rahab in pieces, who pierced the dragon? Was it not you who dried up the waters of the great deep, who made the depths of the sea a way for the redeemed to pass over? So we have this kind of image that the sea is this place of chaos, and God can impose order on it. And the first was speaking in the original story. Isaiah 51:15-16 says the same thing about, in this case, God stirs up the sea and its waves roar. And we have this elsewhere as well. The Isaiah 17:12-13, all the Gentile nations are compared to the sea, because Israel was kind of compared to land. You know, after all, they went through a creation through the Red Sea, where they passed over on dry land. They became the special land in the middle of the other lands, the sea. So Isaiah 17:12-13, ah, the thunders of many peoples, they thunder like the thundering of the sea. Ah, the roar of the nations, they roar like the mighty roaring of mighty waters. The nations roar like the roaring of many waters, but he will rebuke them, and they will flee far away. He chased like chaff on the mountains before the wind, they are chased like chaff on the mountains before the wind and whirling dust before the storm. So It's not universally negative, by the way, because eventually the sea kind of calms down and it's like glass in Revelation. The sea is like glass around the throne, so that's kind of a picture. But for a while, we have this kind of environment of chaos that has to be limited. It's shown to be sometimes good because the sea has potential. Isaiah 60, verse 5, "Then you shall see the and be radiant. Your heart shall thrill and exult, because the abundance of the sea shall be turned to you. The wealth of the nations shall come into you." So it's not necessarily evil. I mean, God created it after all. But for a time, it's kind of, there's parts of life, they're chaos. And so, this is kind of the analogy, the metaphor that's used for the ongoing, we've got a lot of potential in here, but we don't necessarily need to let it all out. All right? Water can be good, and water can come in the flood and wash you all away. And you want, you know, actually, there is some irony that I think twice now you've talked about me pouring stuff out, and I'm actually saying that, no, I want it to trickle out. I want valuable words to come out. I've got too much to say, but, you know, it's not all constructive. The words of a man's mouth are deep waters, so the purpose of a man's heart is deep water. That isn't necessarily referring to some deep evil thoughts per se. There's wickedness and evil in people, and it will hide there. But that's not. But even so, the point is, you've got too much. And remember, you want to. It's not just you don't want to say a good thing. There's no such thing as a good thing in the abstract. You want to say a good thing for the situation. Like Paul writes to the Ephesians, you want to build up people according to the needs of the moment. Pouring out deep waters is never helpful. And in order to be a fountain of wisdom, you need to speak with a purpose. In the words of the Apostle Paul, "Only such is good as for building up as fits the occasion, that it may give grace to those who hear." Otherwise, silence is the better option. Even a fool who keeps silent is considered wise. If he closes his lips, he is deemed intelligent. And of course, that's true even if you're feeling good. If you're really mad, yeah, it's even more important. Because at that point, your discernment about which words to use goes out the window. Your IQ gets lowered, all right? Just like when you drink. When you're angry, you can get stupid. So a certain amount of chaos, by the way, can represent something good. I mean, what's Proverbs 14:4? "Where there is no oxen, the manger is clean, but abundant crops come through the strength of the ox." So, but the point is, it needs to be bounded to let life go on. The challenge is to sift through your thoughts to say the right words at the right time. "To make an apt answer is a joy to a man, and a word in season, how good it is." Proverbs 15:23. "A word fitly spoken is like apples of gold in setting of silver." Just as a driver has to be careful about when he shoves the gas pedal down or how far he pushes it down, you are called to be selective about how and when you speak and what you say and what tone you use. God spoke order out of chaos. Humans made in God's image can speak in circumstances that have a similar effect, but they can also speak in ways, if they're not careful, that can spread chaos. One of the major ways, and now here I'll just cover some bases with Proverbs. The fact is, this is where I broke down. I had to do two chapters on this because, you know, saying I'm going to say something constructive about speech in Proverbs, well, that's like saying I'm going to talk about half of the book of Proverbs. I mean, that's a lot of the book. So I tried to cover the basic kind of themes. I ended up like with a text file that it was a large. There's a lot of stuff in there. But, you know, the words of a man's mouth are deep waters. You notice that if you start an argument with someone, you know where that will end. Solomon almost, it seems like he uses the same image. "The beginning of strife is like letting out water, so quit before a quarrel breaks out." All right? You know, starting arguments is really frowned upon in Proverbs. Now, people have arguments. There's arguments in the church. Arguments have to happen. But you really need to not want them to happen. They can, if they're a pleasure to you, then you're lost because you'll mess up your life. No one needs unnecessary enemies. No one needs unnecessary hard feelings. That's especially true when you're married to them. I mean, you know, it's that too, right? You got to think about what might happen because you don't have control of that. Once it's out of your mouth, right? It's happened. If it was heard, it's happened. It's objective. It's real. You can't just take it back in. You don't get a do-over. I mean, you can be forgiven, but you know, you've got to, you don't know what happened, so it's better not to say it. Your default attitude is to be averse to controversy. It is an honor of a man to keep aloof from strife, but every fool will be quarreling. People often get into quarrels out of a sense of their own honor, right? But you can see, you know, in young men, it can feel like their reputation is on the line if they don't respond to a real or imagined provocation. Solomon offers us another perspective on honor. It's to stay aloof. It's your honor to be above squabbling. All right? You should consider it beneath your dignity to get involved in arguments. And one of the problems with anger is that if it's not restrained, it will drive you into verbal sparring. And if you control your temper, you can not only hopefully restrain yourself from spreading this chaos, but by example and perhaps by some well-chosen calming words, you can actually reestablish order or help to that end. So a hot-tempered man stirs up strife, but he who is slow to anger quiets contention. All right, so you do get involved in some extent, but you're wise about it, and you try to, as much as possible, make peace between people. The vexation of a fool is known at once, but the prudent ignores an insult. So, you know, basically, your default scenario should be, if a response has to come, I probably don't have to make it the moment that I'm provoked. I can wait. I can deal with this. Especially if that's how you always act, and people know you're not letting anything go while you're silent. You're just the kind of guy who waits and thinks about it before he responds. You actually think about your actions before you commit them. What a horrible thing to be. No, it's a good idea. A fool gives full vent to his spirit, but a wise man quietly holds it back. So again, you want to be wise, you want to be powerful, you want to be strong. Be strong enough to control these emotions. I mean, they're good. They're if you heard the person right, they might be reasonable. They're not necessarily bad, but they shouldn't be immediate. They shouldn't cause immediate spontaneous action in most circumstances, because that could possibly be misdirected, and that will lead to other things, and it will go on from there. It'll be like letting out water. You know, you will have opinions about people. They don't need to know what they are. Whoever belittles his neighbor lacks sense, but a man of understanding remains silent. Whoever goes about slandering reveals secrets, but he who is trustworthy in spirit keeps a thing covered. I wonder about that English word slander there, because slander, I think, implies false information. I think the old English was talebearer. So I don't know that it's really supposed to be referring to false information, because the person who is trustworthy keeps a thing covered. So he's not refraining from lying. He's refraining from spreading information that's not helpful to the person about who that information refers to. There are times to say what you know or what you think you know about others, but our default behavior must be restraint. What time is this supposed to end, by the way? 3. Okay, good. I lose... You know, I speak too many words and I start forgetting basic facts about my situation. The words of a whisper are like delicious morsels. They go down to the inner parts of the body. That really gives some guidance. Are you telling someone something because it's worthwhile to know, or is it giving you some kind of thrill to reveal that information? It seems to be... That's in 18:8, and something similar is also in 26:22. Maybe the same, actually, maybe repeated twice. I pay attention to repetitions because I think of 2 witnesses, 3 witnesses that's being emphasized. And I just want to say, I mean, you know, again, this isn't the Torah. It's not saying that it's not like you say something true and because it gave you a thrill, therefore you're evil and you're a sinner and there you can be impeached or something like that. I realize I'm not necessarily modeling the best behavior while I give this lecture on speech and wisdom, but in this case, I'm sorry. But anyway, you know, so you've got these kind of things. So again, remember, if something's pleasant to say, if you get a thrill when you're angry or when you say something hurtful, that feeling is what can encourage you to do it again and again. So you need to be alert to that. And just, even though there are times to be angry, there are times to say things that other people don't want to hear, you have to have a break in your head because you can get carried away. And you're doing it for your own sense of vindication rather than for the good of your real ultimate good and really theirs and anyone else's. You know, so you have to have these kind of, like I say, attitudes or habits. What's your first response? Well, to just be quiet and think for a minute. You know, that kind of thing. You have to have these behaviors because otherwise you become the opposite. And, you know, you get away with it once or twice, but eventually you say something that really makes you suffer for it. And you think, oh, that was unlucky. Well, maybe you could have learned to be a different person and had a more peaceful life. Even, you know, by the way, even getting other people involved to settle disputes, Solomon doesn't say that's a great thing to do. I mean, it's better than the alternative of warfare, and you should do it, but you should actually try to calm things down yourself. So Proverbs 25, the end of verse 7 to verse 10, what your eyes have seen, do not hastily bring in the court, for what will you do in the end when your neighbor puts you to shame? Argue your case with your neighbor himself. Now, that's one of the times in this context, you know, arguing is better than the alternative, okay? And do not reveal another's secret, lest he who hears you bring shame upon you and you have your ill repute have no end. In other words, you see something and you're actually mistaken. And you bring it to court and you end up being humiliated because it turns out you were the person who did the wrong thing, i.e. you quick judge and you made a mistake. So you should actually, when it's only one or two of you, you should try to deal with it at that point, if it can be done. And a lot of times we get cynical about how the other person will respond, but we need to kind of think about these things. We need to be worried about that. You know, church courts are good, but, you know, Paul doesn't say it's wonderful that we settle our disputes in court. He would prefer that we not have disputes. And that if we have disputes, we settle them without even making a public issue at all. We work on that. We try to be the kind of people that will do that. And I guess in a certain sense, when we get a reputation as being someone that other people can do that with, then we might be more able to do that with others because it's not a double standard anymore. You understand what I'm saying? People know that we would be reasonable if we were confronted on something, and therefore they're more likely to be reasonable in response if we feel like we need to bring something up to a brother or sister. Because if you do otherwise, you make unnecessary enemies, and that's just not good. I mean, a brother offended is more unyielding than a strong city. And quarreling is like the bars of a castle. That's Proverbs 18:19. Now, you know, there's a sense in which there's a double standard here. You need to not be provoked to anger and speech and all that, in order to not provoke other people to anger. Now, you can always say to the other person, well, the fact that I just yelled at you shouldn't make you so mad. That's not very convincing. That's going to make it worse. The point is, there's a double standard. You should work on two things: not provoking others, and not being provoked. And you know, it's supposed to be a double safety mechanism. You both have a fireproof house, and you don't set fire on other people's houses. It's not unfair. It's double production, and you then have modeled this, and you can maybe get other people to adopt that same self-reductions. Instead of always worrying that, you know, if I don't get provoked to anger, that means people will say whatever they want about me or to me. And well, actually, a lot of them want the thrill of the argument anyway, so it will actually calm things down if you just don't get angry in response to what people say. For lack of wood, the fire goes out. Where there is no whisper, quarreling ceases. So, over and over again in Proverbs, you know, speech is a problem. It's a vulnerability. It's a point of easy damage in your life. And you have to be careful about it. You know, it's true. Jeremiah talked about God's message to him as a prophet being a fire burning in his bones and it has to get out there. But he didn't actually like that. He did not want to talk, but this was God's prophecy to him. So he had to speak because God said so. And he knew bad things were going to happen if he spoke. That's the opposite of saying, I don't care about the future. I'm just speaking without thinking because of this pressure you feel in yourself. So my son, be attentive to my wisdom and incline your ear to my understanding, that you may keep discretion and your lips may guard knowledge. You know, Solomon in general, we've all become very aware of privacy issues and stuff we say on social media because we've had like 10 years of practice blowing up our lives by it and all that. So it's dawning. But even before the internet, Solomon was about, you know, keep private things private. You don't need to necessarily share with the crowd what's going on in your life. People will misunderstand. People will take advantage of you. And, you know, this is in a context where he's encouraging peace between people. But it also encourages like a reasonable concern about what happens when your private nature, material story gets out too widely. You know, you want to control that. So we still got like 8 minutes, but I'm not going to try to say everything I have to do about toxic cult talk. This looks good in print, but when I say it, it trips me up. Leave toxic talk cultures. But there's a lot about how you learn to speak from other people and how you should watch who you're around because they'll teach you how to speak. You adopt your native language, so you think about that. But I'll stop there. Are there any questions or comments? Or, you know, think carefully before you ask. So. That's actually wise. Yeah, they had a whole time to think about it before you.
We see increasing godlessness in all kinds of different ways, you know, sexuality and things like that. But another thing that has been on the rise in the last 2 decades has been gambling. And I was just wondering if anything that you had to say about that and saw would apply to gambling.
Yeah, everything. I mean, first of all, as a person, you know, okay, back up a minute. I'm going to have to say something previous to that. You know, I just recently I read something about the law of God and saying a preacher preaching from the pulpit not being able to say certain things because they're not the law of God. God's word does not say have a $1,000 emergency fund. That's not in there. I've read some of what's in there. It says, you know, wine and oil should be in the house, not consumed immediately. You know, but that's what it says. It doesn't say have $1,000 emergency fund to start with. All right. So it's really hard in reading Proverbs and trying to figure out how to teach it to restrain yourself from making judgments that aren't actually in Scripture or aren't commands in this direction. Because the whole point is you're trying to run your life. You're trying to build on the commands, but you're trying to do more. I mean, Solomon, like I said, it's not a sin to be angry. God was angry. It's not a sin to speak to people the truth. That's the apostles and prophets do that all the time. Jesus did it. So it's really weird. I mean, you kind of have to. I mean, what Solomon does is talk about different groups of people and their characteristics. So, if someone finds it entertaining to buy a lottery ticket instead of coffee at Starbucks, which is probably going to cost them more, I'm just kidding. But you know what I'm saying? I mean, I don't have much to say about that. I was raised, I don't even peel off the stickers off like McDonald's cups when they're running their little games and stuff. I never do that. I don't even allow myself to think about the possibility of getting something in that way. I don't know why. It's just, I think it's the way I was raised. It's, you know, habits are shackles, right? I think gambling is very bad. And if you are pursuing if you're being hasty to get wealth, you'll put yourself in poverty so fast and so immensely. And people are doing that. And it is, you've got to think of all these. I think all these things should be should be thought of as drugs. Because at some point, it goes beyond, you know it's stupid. You know it's absolutely garbage. But you get depressed and you've got a whole hormonal cycle going on where your depression makes you depressed. Or that was redundant, sorry. Something like that. But you get depressed. And you've got a behavior that you do that comforts you. But it also makes you, it's what makes you depressed. And your situation gets worse. And the situation gets worse and more desperate, so therefore you want to do the behavior because it makes doing the other thing, being honest, saving your money look even more impossible. So yeah, it's an absolute metaphor for all of this, and it's an instance of it. It's a trap as to whether it should be legal and whether it should be stopped out, and what it say about, you know, a family, a group of neighbors who are playing for nickels, pennies, and dimes on a poker table. That's, you know, wisdom would tell you to make distinctions. So I don't have an answer. I mean, I have worries and concerns, and I have things I would do to raise my children or try to direct them in a way that they wouldn't impoverish themselves through that behavioral cycle. I mean, I do think it's kind of ironic that one of the ways it becomes so glitzy and attractive is that we make it illegal everywhere but in Las Vegas, you know, Slee Central. And then they'll get built up big and strong and, you know, huge, and funnel money from the CIA, whatever they were doing. And then after a while we spread it to other places. But, you know, each time, everywhere it spreads, it gets less and less special, more and more obviously sleazy. I mean, talk about not being attracted to something. You know, these casinos in Washington State, and one on every, you know, wherever, I don't know how the system worked, but there were lots of casinos, and they did not look like places I wanted to go. So I don't know how legally to handle it, but I would say that, you know, you're supposed to be a steward, you're supposed to multiply what you have. And sometimes that's not just a metaphor for money. Money's not a metaphor for that. That really is money. You're supposed to be out with money. So not waste it. I it's interesting. I thought about that. I mean, I did get scratch and stuff, at work. Some guy bought us all his work coworkers. This is like those scratch off, you know, what are they called? Stuff that's what? Yeah, scratch tickets. I guess that's what they're called. Anyway, lottery tickets. There we go. That's what it's word lottery. And I went ahead and I thought, well, let's see. I drink from coffee from a Keurig because I got that for free. So I'll scratch these off and take whatever's for free there. So I did scratch them off. But, you know, me, I'm such a, I don't even buy stuff of any kind for my coworkers. I mean, we're just coworkers. We're not buddies. I mean, that's ridiculous. But anyway, I said thank you, but. So that if people want to do that, that's a way of being generous to other people now. I guess that does work. You don't have to give them a gift, and if you happen to accidentally give them $5,000, then I guess that's fine. I mean, it didn't cost you any differently one way or the other. So I don't know how, you know. So yeah, gambling is a big deal, and I could have talked about that, even though it's not. I don't think it's only referred to in Proverbs, I think, as a way of settling an argument. Like, you know, rolling the dice. I don't think anything else is talked about. All right. Anything else? Yes.
The lecture on speech spoke somewhat to this, but Proverbs being character development for yourself speaks so much about not addressing it to fools because they're not going to listen anyway. And we're developing ourselves to be better stewards than kings of the world. What then is the king's responsibility to the slothful people?
Well,
not easily taking that advice.
Okay. For the literal king will have to deal with the attendant damage and, you know, all that. But us, as wise people, the best thing we can do is present a consistent model of wisdom. And if the fools become receptive, then, you know, ask you a question, ask you for input, we can try to give them input. But showing that it works is probably the best argument. And I mean, of course, what they'll do and what we all do is anyone who's better off than us through their behavior will. That's because they're just that way. We try to kind of make them into exceptions, and I'm a different person. And everything is, we got to remember, everything is aimed this way. I was telling someone, I don't know if that was, I mean, I saw a movie about where the movie featured a young female who's looking, I guess, for romantic interest, but he met all these unfaithful people who were like cheating either on their wife or on their fiance. And she's like, how can you do this? she's like, you know, she actually responded, foolishly responded to an ad for a guy who wanted to date someone before he decided to jump into marriage, even though he'd already gotten engaged and his fiance wasn't in town and didn't know he was doing this. It was complete garbage. And she doesn't go far with him. She just basically says, you know, this is ridiculous. Why would you do this? And he's like, well, I haven't made up my mind yet. He says, no, you should break it off because she needs to know that you're like this. She doesn't want to marry you. I mean, anyway, and then he says something that's said to the whole movie, and the movie actually somewhat seemed to take this perspective. Don't be so simple. It's complicated. Like, well, yeah, your life is complicated if you blow it up with unfaithfulness and bad habits and chaos, and yeah, your life will get complicated. But the wise people aren't uncomplicated. They're just not committing slow suicide is what they're doing. They're not wrecking their lives. And I think you just got to try to convince people when they're open to it that, I mean, because one of the discouragements is once you've been foolish for a while and you've got the damage, you know, you're going to have to work hard undoing, or to the extent that you can be done, all that stuff, you know, as well as not making up for lost time. You know, debt, gambling debt, that is a good example that way. And some people, you know, are forced into debt. You know, people's lives do vary. It's not like every wise person is going to be rich and famous and independent. That's not true. The Bible talks about servants who are wise and rich people that are fools. So Proverbs talks about that. Solomon talks about that. So it's not like you have control over everything or that God's promising you everything. There's a whole chapter in the book, by the way, that says that Proverbs is not different than Ecclesiastes. So, and actually I sprinkle those kind of qualifications throughout the book. I didn't really say any of them, you know, spell any of them here when I was talking about it that much. So I think it's very hard to help a fool or to help anyone in their foolishness, which we all have some foolishness, right? So the best thing to do is generally put out this message and make them all feel guilty and, you know, in general, without personally attacking anyone. And let people, as I say, you know, in a sense, that's what I mean by disciple yourself. You know, I'm dealing with the scriptures. I'm trying to come up, show you an aspect of scriptures that might have been missed before or undervalued. I undervalued it, so I needed to have written this book, you know, 20, 30 years ago. I've been much, much better off now. But it's still, you know, get people to take stock of what they say. And I know people have been converted by reading. I mean, actually, I have a friend who told me that his foster son was being very degenerate, and he read Proverbs and decided, I'm in the Bible, and I don't want to be that way. And so he actually converted. And, you know, I mean, the fool does end up being a wicked person. I don't think foolishness is exactly the same as evil in all cases, but it gets you there if you're not there already. So that's the best I can do. I have to say, you know, they've done, and this I'm getting from secular scholarship, and I mentioned Jordan Peterson. You know, they've taken people that are like in unproductive, bad situations and experimented with putting them in really good teams, like work teams, like in companies, and tried to see if they would like rise to the occasion. And overwhelmingly, they don't. Overwhelmingly, they actually drag everyone else down and make them all miserable because they all have to make up for this person's lack of this person's problems. And so helping people is really hard. And that's why the desire to help people has to be really, I think, going outside of anything I was prepared to talk about. But in a sense, Proverbs is telling you to wake up to the fact that if you're in foolishness, you're under a spell. And you got an opportunity to wake up, but there's not much else I can do for you, says Solomon, you know, speaking of whatever. Because, yeah, it does kind of say, well, if you're a fool, you're not going to listen to me anyway. And then, but, you know, you notice that. I did that one passage. Even a fool, if he keeps silent. So you tell somebody who realizes they might be a fool, look, let's start with something. You could just at least keep your mouth shut. And I don't think Solomon, like I've written this recently, I don't think Solomon is saying, you know, okay, there are fools, but at least you can be less foolish. I think he's saying, you know, you got to start small and you can work on it, but you got to start somewhere. So he's opening the door to there being a way out, but it's hard to take. And You know, Jesus, that was the issue with, you know, Jesus and the Pharisees. That was one of the issues, was that they were convinced they were wise, and therefore Jesus had to be wrong. And they were going to bend all reality and come up with 1,000 rationalizations why. All right? We don't see people doing that in our own milieu, but yeah, I mean, people don't want to admit that they've made a big mistake, that they're on a dead end. So it's very hard. And Peter Lighthart argues that the saved people are being dragged away from to death. That's actually an exhortation to teach people wisdom. I'm not sure. I didn't disagree with him in the book. And is this still being recorded? Yeah, well, anyway, I'm not sure Peter's right about something. It's amazing. I'll think about it, but it would encourage you in Proverbs would be to intervene as early as you can if you're going to intervene. That's one. So you're in a good place. Well, you're usually right, but I just wonder about it because it is really hard to help people. I mean, and the other thing is I thought about this, and this is not Proverbs. This is something I thought of a long time generally in counseling people. To me, it's a challenge because when you counsel someone. And when you try to help in their lives and they're obviously having problems, you are at the one hand, you are trying to get them to be a more productive Christian adult. You're trying to help them grow up and be sanctified. On the other hand, the relationship is you're almost treating them like a child. And that dynamic is hard to maintain the balance because you don't want them. They're not a child. I mean, they may need to be humble and they need to listen to you, but they're not a child. The object is to make them an adult, right? You know, when the child is a child, you don't have that worry. But as an adult, you do. So in a sense, you know, I wonder about how do you help people? Because you want to encourage them to be an adult, but at the same time, it's easy to treat them like children. And because sometimes adults are overgrown children, obviously. And so it's just difficult. It's hard. I guess that means I really don't know the answer to your question. But I found a long way to say that. But I don't think anyone does. I mean, people convert, but, you know, their biography, there's all sorts of influences that go into that. It's hard to say what was the presenting thing that actually is the reason why they changed. Anything else? Well, I really enjoyed it today, and I am thankful. I mean, weirdly, I was kind of worried about not having enough material, and of course, I did left half the pages in the notebook. That's fine. Thank you for your time. I hope that you'd find this helpful. I hope if you get a chance to read the book that you'll find it more helpful. And thank you for this opportunity. It's a very, very great honor.